Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is The Hunt for Nazi Spies in Ireland. At the outbreak of the Second World War, the Irish Free State Government adopted a policy of neutrality. Now, while this ensured Ireland was not invaded, numerous Nazi agents were smuggled into Ireland to gather intelligence and develop contacts with the IRA, who shared their hostility towards Britain. Therefore, during the war, Irish military intelligence had to launch a relentless pursuit of these spies. Often cooperating with British counter-espionage, this was a highly successful operation as they captured all known German agents who landed on the island. Now, in this episode, I interview Mark McMenamin, the author of two books, Ireland's Secret War and Codebreaker. Mark has researched and written extensively on Irish efforts to counter Nazi operatives in Ireland during the war. So in this show, he explains this fascinating story, how the IRA were entangled with the Nazis, the often comical attempts by the Nazis to infiltrate Ireland during the war, and the forgotten story of Irish codebreakers as well. But I began the interview by asking Mark to explain who exactly Irish military intelligence were. They're often referred to as G2, but their history is not that well known. As Mark now explains, it emerged from the intelligence division of the IRA in the War of Independence.
It essentially forms out of the nucleus of intelligence section of the IRA from Michael Collins. It goes through various iterations. You know, it really comes into its fore, though, then when we're looking at the Second World War, because up until that point, you know, you don't really, I suppose it's when the common enemy comes along, that is Nazi Germany and kind of the looming clouds of fascism, as I would say, in Europe. Up until that point, pretty much like a lot of the focus with the people in the army is kind of looking at Britain. You have to remember it's 20 odd years after the War of Independence, the Civil War, coming up to when you come up to the period of the emergency. So the focus isn't really there, you know, on what we call external threats to the state, to the nascent Irish state. And the person that really kind of sees the woods from the trees really on this is Dan Bryan. And in the mid-30s, he senses what's going on in Europe, what's going on the continent. He sees kind of what's happening with Mussolini, what's happening with Hitler, you know, the rise of fascism. And he senses almost immediately this can be a threat to Ireland, okay, from a security point of view, which is very prescient of him. You know, he's really ahead of his time here, and he's kind of quite alone in the army and in the government on this. He's really quite ahead of his time. So the crucial thing about Bryan as well is, as a character, and if we look at kind of intelligence as a whole up until the outbreak of the war, is that he was an excellent intelligence chief, in that he kept in with people that he might necessarily have been friends with people that were on the opposite side with him in the Civil War. So he had a good working relationship with, you know, people that were anti-treaty Republicans. Everyone kind of respected Dan. And because of that, he was able to kind of put together, see the bigger picture, that we have this looming threat of fascism. We have disgruntled elements in the IRA. We have the rump of the IRA, like, that's still there, that didn't side with De Valera, didn't embrace some of the Gael and kind of free statism and whatever else. And he senses that there could be a link here, right? And there could be a problem coming down the line. And Republicans probably could be used as a kind of a fifth column by Nazi Germany. or by other foreign powers, and he senses the danger in that, and therein lies the problem, you know, and thus that became the nucleus of what he was trying to achieve. He pens this memorandum, Fundamental Factors Affecting Irish Defence Policy, which was way ahead of its time. He outlined kind of all the strategic ways in which Ireland could be vulnerable to an attack, could be vulnerable to spies, etc. And it was quite alarming. And this eventually circulates in government, around various government levels. It circulates around members of the army, and it kind of awakens them just about in the nick of time.
So while Irish military intelligence had come to recognise the threat posed by the Nazis by the late 1930s, this was matched, however, by a growing interest in Ireland by German intelligence. This often took the form of seemingly harmless cultural exchanges, but it appears they were seeking to cultivate relations with the IRA.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I mean, it's not as if they suddenly just kind of developed this interest out of the clear blue sky. Like, there's links with Germany that go back years and years, and there's always been kind of a German presence in Ireland. If you go back to the Ardna Crusher scheme, German thing, you know, there was German labour involved in that, German engineering expertise. So the cultural links were always there. And in the 20s and in the 30s, especially when you come into the 1930s, the early 1930s, you know, just as kind of Hitler comes to power, but before the outbreak of the war, that decade in the 1930s, you have cultural exchanges between Ireland and Germany. You have Germans who are traveling over here, they're doing courses in, you know, various, mainly in the arts, actually, in Trinity College, but various different disciplines. Some of them come over to study folklore. I mean, there's a guy, Malthusen, he managed to make it as far as Donegal, where I'm from, the Donegal Gaeltacht, you know. But what was happening is when they were going to Irish-speaking areas and areas in the west of Ireland, some of these German students became acquainted with Republicans and with the IRA. Now, whether that was by accident or design, the jury is out on that, although, you know, there are extensive MI5 files on some of these German students that came over, and they would have been members of political organizations, you know, so it's highly likely that maybe, you know, it was by design. You know, some of them always denied that, you know, some of the German students that came over, but one way or another, there's connections there made, very tenuous, you know, tenuous connections, but relationships are built up. And one of those is you know, Tom Barry, who becomes acquainted with some of the German students that come over here. But that develops, you know, the IRA at this particular time is a kind of tumultuous organization. It doesn't kind of really know its role. It's kind of its place. You know, there's chief of staff changes several times in the IRA at this particular period. It all kind of comes to a fore of the period of the 30s, eventually when Sean Russell becomes the chief of staff of the IRA. It's then when it's probably decided by the Abwehr that there's an opportunity for Ireland to be used or to be exploited. Now, from what I've read and what I've looked at in various documents, their knowledge, I suppose, of what Ireland is really like on the ground is probably not the best in terms of the intelligence gathering that they had. You know, they seem to have this perception that Ireland, that the IRA was kind of this rising army, like, that was going to just sweep the country, like, and help them as a fifth column. But really, it was kind of a ragtag bag of misfits, like, a lot of them kind of were at odds with each other. They were largely in disarray. And that doesn't really change until Sean Russell comes in and you're looking at the S plan when they start targeting various cities in London and all that. It's then that they really see that there's an opportunity here to make some serious linkage here, because everyone knows the war is coming. You know, it's kind of inevitable at this stage towards the end of the 1930s. It's only then when Russell comes in and Russell comes to the fore, he reorganizes the IRA into somewhat more a formidable force. He puts shape on the organization. And it's there then that they begin to really see them as an asset.
Our conversation moved through the 1930s, and Mark explained how the Nazis viewed Ireland by the outbreak of the Second World War and outlined some of their plans in relation to the island.
Well, you see, the thing is, there's various iterations of various different plans. And, you know, some of them have commonalities, some of them are different. You know, one of the plans was this Plan Kathleen, which was to use the IRA to kind of create political instability in Northern Ireland to give the Germans the pretense then to invade, to kind of defend the native Irish, you know, and that was their end then. You know, you had Operation Shamrock then, which was to invade the south, you know, coming in kind of at Wexford there. So, I mean, well, ultimately what they want is, this is all happening in But, you know, in the context of the Battle of Britain, you have to look at this because, you know, like you're just after Dunkirk, you are looking at the fact that the British have received an almighty bloody nose. France is, you know, France is gone. You know, so they're standing alone and they're extremely vulnerable. So if they can open up a second front from Ireland and on the other side, it's a pincer style movement, you know, when they're going to squeeze them from two sides. Now, you know, how realistic that is that they're going to be able to invade Ireland, there would have been air support, I suppose, from the RAF. They would have ultimately come in and defended Ireland. It's hard to know how successful it would have been. I would imagine probably not very successful, but that's what they're looking at, ultimately. Now, that all changes then, of course, you know, with the Blitz in London and how, I suppose, how the RAF ultimately defend London. And then Operation Barbarossa, Hitler kind of changes his whole tactics anyway. Then, you know, he opens the war on two fronts for himself, never mind trying to open it up on two fronts for the British. So there's a whole change in scenario then. But that would have been ultimately been, that was ultimately where they were coming from.
During this period, multiple German agents landed in Ireland. Before we look at some of these individuals, Mark explains how a lot of their work was observational rather than actually carrying out acts of military sabotage.
The most important thing in all, of all in terms of war, in terms of intelligence gathering, is the weather. I think most people, and myself included, up until I kind of studied this in more detail, you know, you would think when you hear intelligence and spying and all that, they must be stealing top secret documents. But usually it's to get in and see what the weather is like, you know, in terms of planning attacks and invasions. And in recent years, you know, it's just shown how important that has been in Ireland in terms of the D-Day landings. There was some great work done by filmmaker Gerry Gregg a number of years ago, a documentary, Stormfront from Mayo, you know, the Black Sod episode out there and all that. So it just shows you how crucial that information is. But also the land border as well, with Northern Ireland there with the UK. I mean, it's relevant today. You know, you see it with Brexit. It was the same thing back then. You know, they're close to Northern Ireland. They can get in. They can see troop movement in the north, everything that's going on in Derry, for example. So there are various different reasons why they wanted to be in Ireland and have a presence in Ireland. And if the invasion, if a possible or fated invasion of Ireland wasn't going to happen or never happen, they were still very dangerous to have on Irish soil in terms of the intelligence that they could gather. Because if the Irish decided to share nothing with the British, that's, you know, Dan Bryan decided to have a very good security relationship with MI5, with the MI5's Irish section under Guy Liddell. It was a total black spot for British intelligence. They didn't know what was going on right under their nose.
While we will look at some of the individual agents who reached Ireland later in the episode, Mark first explained what has become one of the more well-known chapters in this secret war. That was the visit of the IRA Chief of Staff, Sean Russell, to Nazi Germany in 1940. However, he would die on board a German U-boat as he returned to Ireland. But Mark now explains what exactly Russell was doing in Germany and his somewhat complex motivations.
Russell travels to Germany and he's trained by the Abwehr, you know, in subversive techniques and explosives and everything. And the idea is to send him back to Ireland, basically, in terms of aiding this kind of plan to invade Ireland, to give the Germans a context with which to invade and to uphold Irish neutrality. Because you have to remember as well, at this particular period, obviously there's the threat of German invasion, but Irish sovereignty as well, kind of under some trouble as well, in terms of maybe perhaps a preemptive invasion from one of the Allied sides, you know, to try and prevent, you know, so you're kind of in trouble both ways. You're treading a very precarious line here. And there's an opportunity there, you know, for Russell and them to exploit that. So, I personally find it strange with Russell. He's someone that kind of divides opinion with so many different people and so many different levels. I kind of find it hard to kind of criticize him in a lot of ways because, I mean, he seems to be kind of carrying on the Republican struggle that, you know, up until not that long beforehand, a lot of the people that are trying to stop him were at the same thing, you know. So he's a divisive figure. Like, even since my book came out, I've seen some people, you know, some reviews, you know, kind of criticizing Russell, some defending him, you know. But the reality is he's there to be exploited by the Nazis. And I wonder, and I've wondered this, and there's no proof. I mean, there's absolutely no proof that Russell was anti-Semitic or anything like that. I don't think he was anything like that at all. But I wonder, was he extremely naive in who he was dealing with when he was dealing with the Nazis? And you have to weigh up the price then that you would pay for Irish freedom. I mentioned in the book that on Eichmann's list there of European Jews, Jewish people in Ireland are enumerated on that list. Like, so at what cost would this have been worth it? So these are the things that kind of come to the fore when you look at Russell. There's kind of a lot of questions there. It's kind of lazy, I don't know if it's lazy, but just to say that he was an outright kind of anti-Semitic, kind of a Nazi supporter. I think there's a lot more to it than that. So I wouldn't take an opinion on either side on him, you know, but I think he's a very interesting character. And sadly, someone that probably isn't studied as much as he should be.
I was keen to hear about some of the individual agents. Mark now explains who some of the actual people who were captured during the war were.
I mean, they sent over a number of different contacts. There was ultimately, I think, 7 or 8. I mean, one of the guys that was here was a guy called Werner Altman, who was actually a sleeper agent. So he was actually here before the war, before he eventually awoke. But most of them, it was ridiculous kind of stuff. It was Keystone Cops kind of stuff. And, you know, it begs the question, like, did they take Ireland seriously at all, or like were they so stretched during the war that they were sending just complete idiots? Like, because it's like some of the guys, it was ridiculous. There was one spy, a guy called Walter Simon, arrives in Dingle and he ends up in the pub. Like, he ends up with a whiskey and he comes into the pub. It was Nelligan's pub. I was in it myself. I had to go in for a spy pint, and you know, but he comes in and he slams the table with his fist. And I was speaking to some of the, you know, locals who heard the stories of this. And he slams his fist on the table and he says, the poverty of Ireland will disappear when Hitler comes to power in this country. And I mean, you can imagine now, like in Dingle on a Friday night, like in 1930, this lad, Germanic voice, comes in and starts doing this. So it wasn't too long before this fella, like the special branch were onto him and he was lifted. So this was the kind of thing that they were dealing with. Another German spy, a guy called Wilhelm Freit, bought himself a kind of a Cadillac, a real flashy car, and used to drive around Dublin and picking up girls. Like, so, you know, it wasn't too long before, and you have to remember, Dublin's a lot smaller place back then as well. It wouldn't be hard for you to stick out. Like,
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As Mark continued, he began to conjure up a picture of more comical escapades than anything else.
Some of them were given pretty good instructions, but how well they carried those out now is a different story. You know, they got easily distracted. They kind of seemed to be on a party when they're over here, a lot of them. You know, some of them were to gather economic espionage. For example, there was one spy, Wilhelm Freitz, and their mission parameters would have varied from person to person. Wilhelm Freitz, for example, he actually went out and he spied on Baldonnell and he spied on some of the military installations. The quality of that intelligence, it's kind of arguable if it was any good, you know. Weather reports, weather information, they came with transmitters and they were trying to kind of transmit this information back to Berlin then. But G2 were trying to monitor the airwaves, you know, to see what was coming in terms of radio traffic. And they had several people who were kind of installed in various houses in Dublin trying to read the radio traffic to see was there illicit communications being broadcast over the airways. They didn't tend to venture into Northern Ireland, although towards the end of the war, some of them did. But there was a good working relationship then between, I suppose, the RUC Special Branch and then Dan Bryan and everybody else. The guy in charge of the RUC Special Branch has the best name I think you could possibly have if you were to be involved in catching spies. His name was Roger Moore. So I thought that was very funny when I came across that. That actually is his name. So Roger Moore had a good relationship with Dan Bryan, you know, with the various guys in the Garda Special Branch. And they kept pretty good tabs on all these guys.
While most of these German agents were arrested in the first 24 hours after they landed in Ireland, one in particular managed to evade capture for over a year. Mark now explains who Hermann Goertz was and how he managed to evade the Irish authorities for so long.
They were all lifted straight away within 24 hours, except for Hermann Goertz. Hermann Goertz is on the loose for nearly a year. Now, there's no real concrete, nobody really knows why that was. And there's a number of different schools of thought on that. they say that he just got lucky every time. Every time, like, the special branch and military intelligence closed in on him, he managed to just kind of escape. Like, but then the other thing that the other theory that's out there is that, Gertz was let loose for a little while just to see who he was talking to. And, you know, most of the people in the IRA that he was having any dealings with ended up actually being interned. So, you know, the IRA were extremely annoyed with him because of that. So it's not entirely concrete, I suppose, how Hermann Gertz managed to stay on the loose for so long. But he was the only one. The rest were caught within 24 hours or so, and mainly out of their stupidity. It's amazing, actually, when you look at Hermann Gertz, how he wasn't arrested. Like, there's stories of him. I mean, there's stories of him walking through Newbridge, you know, after he gets parachuted in full Nazi regalia, like, and asking for directions. Like, allegedly, he went into a guard station in Wicklow and asked, did they know where the IRA was? Like, so these are the stories that you hear. I mean, how true they are, I don't know. How he wasn't lifted, like, apparently the guards in Qualifuca give him directions, like, and sent him on his way, like, into town. So maybe they thought he was mad, I don't know. But you would wonder how he did come to the attention of people a lot sooner. They did make one attempt to try and arrest him in Temple Obe, and he managed to escape, but he was caught then, almost a year later, he's caught in Clontarf. And it's actually funny, when he's caught in Clontarf, it's almost by accident. They were actually trying to raid another house, and they raided the wrong house, and they found him in it. Like, so it's a strange one, you know, and there's no real hard and fast answer why. But I would speculate, if it was my own opinion, I would say they probably let him loose for a little while to see who he was talking to, because, like, you know, ultimately, I don't think he wasn't a huge threat. You know, he was a threat in terms of the threat he could pose, like, but he wasn't the brightest button. And you know, he seemed like, from what I've read, and when you look at, like, because he wrote a complete account of everything he did here, like, he spent half his time womanizing, like, and going out in Dublin. Like, people, from what I gather from reading, like, you know, out in the nightlife in Dublin, people were like, that's the spy. I mean, I came across, I came across, like, a debate in the Dáil. I actually quoted it in the book because it's brilliant. I can't remember the name of the TD. But it was kind of a bit of sparring between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. The Fine Gael guy says, you know, oh, he knows as much as the parachutist. So even they were kind of joking about it in the Dáil, that there was a parachutist, the guy that had come down on the loose. So it's just a strange one.
The fact he managed to avoid capture for an entire year left me wondering who was helping him. A German living in Ireland during the Second World War would naturally draw down attention, so he clearly must have had local support in Ireland.
Yeah, like, he was mainly put up by, there was actually two sisters in Glenageary, the Farrell sisters, and they actually looked after him, and he stayed with them, and they were kind of the support network. And then there was other people, various contacts in the Republican movement. I wouldn't say, he's meant to have met up with one of the generals in the army, General Hugo McNeill. Yeah, so he's meant to have had a meeting with him. They say that two TDs might have met with him as well. This is kind of the stuff that comes out. There's nothing quite concrete on it. He's able to be on the loose, and he kind of goes around on the charity of others, you know, and he's living off the back of that their people are willing to put him up and look after him. I mean, one of the places he stays with Isild Gonn, you know, Mad Gonn's daughter. They put him up in the house, and, you know, there's some kind of evidence that he might have had an affair then with Isild Gonn, and she put him up. I think Mark Hull discusses that in his book Irish Secrets, excellent book on this period, you know, that people should check out, as well as my own. And Mark's done excellent research in all of this. So, yeah, you know, like, he lives largely on the charity of others and people putting him up. And he has those connections within kind of within the Republican movement that they're not sympathetic to the German cause by any means, but they sense the opportunity here that it might be useful to help get back to six counties. So he knocks around within that milieu very much so.
While many of the German agents were captured through incompetence, Irish military intelligence had also developed a code-breaking team. Now, these people have been almost entirely forgotten by history, but Mark explains more about them now.
There wasn't any expertise in the army at the time to break German codes. And I mentioned earlier that they were watching the radio waves, you know, to see were there any spies, people communicating. And they actually did hear illicit radio traffic, and it came from, surprise, surprise, the German embassy, the German legation. So they were using a transmitter there to communicate back to Berlin. But sure, they had no expertise in the Irish army to break codes, like, not at all. So Dr. Richard Hayes was a well-known intellectual, and he was the director of the National Library. They seconded him into military intelligence, and they gave him a code-breaking team made up of some civil servants, some actual members of Angard the Shia Khanna, and actually, very interestingly enough as well, a young Kevin Boland, the arms trial Kevin Boland, ends up with this code-breaking team as well. The whole operation is so top secret that the young Kevin Boland isn't even allowed to tell his father, Gerald Boland. He's the Minister for Justice at the time. So it's, you know, it's incredible stuff. But Hayes has great success at figuring out how this code works. He doesn't eventually break it. But when the German spies come into Ireland, then they're carrying their instructions and their means of communication back to Berlin. It's all encrypted and it's all encoded through using ciphers. Hayes is very successful in breaking all of those codes. The code that Hermann Goetz is carrying, which later becomes known as the Goetz cipher, is an extremely sophisticated cipher. And Hayes breaks that. The guys in Bletchley Park actually come over to Dublin to see how to break this, you know, because they're having some difficulty with it themselves.
Finally, as our interview drew to a close, I asked Mark about the overall impact of Irish military intelligence during the Second World War.
I think they played a hugely significant role. And I think like people like Dan Bryan, Dr. Richard Hayes, there are many others as well. But take those two, for example. I think they played a hugely instrumental role in Irish history. And I think they've been sadly kind of left out of the historical record. I don't think people realise how pivotal a character Dan Bryan is in the history of this country in terms of keeping Ireland neutral and keeping Ireland out of the worst kind of excesses of the war. He kind of he walks a very kind of a thin line. It's a kind of a, you know, it's like a tightrope, because he's sharing security information with the British because he knows it's the best thing to do, even though he has come from that. He's come from the revolution himself, you know, and there's consternation within the army. They're disagreeing with colleagues about this, people that don't agree with what he's doing at all. But ultimately, he was able to kind of see above and beyond that, which was incredible for a man who was, you know, he was a spotter on Bagot Street Bridge during Bloody Sunday. Like, you know, he was very much after revolution. He knows that he has to do things this way because it's the right thing to do for the country. And to have that vision and to have that foresight and to think so far ahead, it's really incredible. I mean, internationally, when you're looking at intelligence operations, it's very unusual for any intelligence organization to kind of achieve nearly all of their outcomes. And G2, they did do that. They apprehended all the German spies that came here that we know of. There's a possibility some might have got slipped through the, you know, the noose that Bryan and his colleagues didn't pick up on. But anyone that came here that was a serious threat to Irish sovereignty, to the Allied war effort, they were all apprehended. And in terms of an intelligence operation that's run like with very little resources by a small crowd of guys, it's incredibly, incredibly successful. I think he should be remembered for that. I think he's an incredible figure in Irish history. And I think I think De Valera's, you know, De Valera makes his famous speech of Ireland standing alone at the end of the war, you know, which I can understand why it was done. You know, he's trying to justify our position in the new post-war world, kind of assert our independence, but it really doesn't do service to really what happened on the ground. That, you know, you have this incredible feat in terms of intelligence of what he did. You have Dr. Richard Hayes, who broke these German codes. He broke one German code that they came over from Bletchley Park to see how to break it. I think it's a tragedy that they're not better known. And, you know, I think the big impetus for me in writing the two books and writing Codebreaker and in writing Ireland's Secret War was that it might just generate a bit of a conversation about these two guys and about what they achieved, and might make people, you know, look towards maybe that they might be, I won't say commemorated, but that they may be more part of the narrative of the Second World War. You look at schools and the way we teach it, like it's largely neutral. You know, it's the glimmer men and kind of rationing and things like that. There's a lot more going on. And I think a famous saying I heard once was that Ireland did everything bar send the troops to help the Allies, you know. I think that would be fair to say. So I think if more people talk about Dan Bryan and talk about Dr. Richard Hayes as a result of my two books, I'd be very happy. That's all I'd want out of them. Bryan and Hayes are both actually honoured in their own ways, which I always thought was brilliant. They brought Richard Hayes over to London. They kind of took him out for the weekend. And they say that he got a medal. Haven't been able to prove that. It was a family member said that he got a medal, like, kind of for helping out and all that, of Churchill. But I've never been able to find the medal or find out behind it. But Dan Bryan himself was brought up then to Derry, actually in civilian clothing, to witness the U-boat surrender in Derry. So the two of them were honoured in their own way.
I'd like to thank Mark for his time, His books, Ireland's Secret War and Codebreaker, are available from Gill Press. I have links to both of them in the show notes below. I would highly recommend checking them out. Until next time, Sloane.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.